We're going to finally finish 1 Kings chapter 8 tonight. And we're going to get started in chapter 9. However, in some ways, we are exiting it sooner than I'd really prefer to. And like a few other places in the Bible, this is one of those chapters that we could camp here for a long time, still not fully explore the depths of its content. So we're going to reread 1 Kings chapter 8, verses 54 to the end, and discuss those passages shortly. But first of all, I feel compelled to revisit verses 27 through 30 for just a few minutes, because within these passages, we have one of the wisest men who ever lived, utterly bewildered in trying to understand and express just who God is, the nature of his substance, how to describe him, how to explain in words and human thought this mysterious reality of God in his presence. So open your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 8. We're just going to read verses 27 through 30. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 378. But can God actually live on earth? Why, heaven itself, even the heaven of heavens, can't contain you. So how much less this house I've built? Even so, Adonai, my God, pay attention to your servant's prayer and plea. Listen to the cry and prayer that your servant is praying before you today, that your eyes will be open towards this house night and day, towards the place concerning which you said my name will be there. In order to listen to the prayer, your servant will pray towards this place. Yes, listen to the plea of your servant and also that of your people Israel when they pray towards this place, here in heaven where you live. And when you hear, forgive. Solomon's frame of reference is that while the temple is called Yehovah's house, God's Beit or Beit in Hebrew, and his dwelling place, that in fact Solomon inherently knows that God does not actually live there, but rather he lives in heaven. And yet, the idea of God living in heaven isn't fully satisfactory to Shlomo's mind, because if heaven is a definable place, it can't then possibly be sufficient to house the limitless Creator. And despite all this, the Lord's presence at the temple is undeniable, because it was literally visible in a cloud that suddenly appeared inside the Hekal, the sanctuary. And even more, Solomon understood that God didn't leave heaven to journey to the temple in Jerusalem to visit his people. I bring this up because it addresses a challenge for the church and for Judaism that, when dealt with poorly, as I regret that in my estimation it has been, often tends towards humanizing God, making him more human. That inevitably tars him with some of our human flaws and characteristics. It places upon him our human expectations as though he was elected prime minister of heaven and earth, not as the self-existent God of everything. And I think in doing so, we have come to feel freer to question God's decisions and reckon, well, he must think logically. He must feel deeply like we do, only at an even greater level. And in the end, the truth is that the more we try to describe God, the more we diminish who he is. The great Jewish sage and philosopher Maimonides, who lived around 1200 AD, known among the Jewish community as the Rambam, thought about this issue long and hard. And no doubt Solomon's prayer at the temple dedication ceremony had much to do with his fascination of the problem of defining the God of Israel. And the idea is that God's attributes expressed in the negative are his true attributes. In other words, at the same time that we can say that God is just, we must also say that God is not unjust. And while we can say that God is wise, we must also say that God is not unwise. Now that might sound like a lot of double talk until we grasp, but Maimonides is saying that unlike humans, the foundational traits of God have no opposites in him. If you remember back to Genesis and our lesson there in chapter 6, we had a lesson that included what I call the principle of opposites. That's a fundamental and immutable trait of our universe. It says that God created our universe based on a foundational law that everything in and of our universe will have an opposite. If there's an up, there's a down. If there's a near, there's a far. If there's light, there's darkness. If there's a male, there's a female. If there's good, there's evil. If there's birth, there's death. On and on and on. And the Rambam tells us that while we can define God best by means of expressing his attributes in the negative, we can't do the same thing with humans. For instance, while we can say with assurance that God is knowing, and must also say then that God is not unknowing, we can't say that same thing regarding humans. That is, while I can say that humans are knowing, I can't say that humans are unknowing, for in fact, humans can be both knowing and unknowing, depending on the individual and on the circumstance. In other words, God is such a holy, other being than humans, that while humans are essentially a fleshly container of opposites, God isn't. A human being's fundamental nature, we are creatures of opposites. A human can exist and then not exist. A human can be powerful and then become weak. A human can be good and then be bad. A human can be here and then it can be over there. A human can be wise and then be foolish. But none of this is true of God. None of it. Because he's not a container of opposites. He is what he is. Or as he said in the burning bush to Moses, I am what I am. Therefore, he's not a man that he could change. We change. He doesn't change. God has no capacity not to exist. God's unable to be weak. God's incapable of being foolish. God's not here or there. He hovered over the deep at creation. He ruled over his angels in heaven, and he was present at the outer edges of the universe for the birth of every star, all at the same time. Not because he chose to be, but because that is his fundamental nature. Therefore, Maimonides writes that we can't know anything about God per se. God's essential character is completely incomprehensible to mortal minds. Human beings at best can only describe what God does in the world, but we'll never be able to discern what God is. And yet that's precisely what the church has insisted upon trying to do for centuries. And it's why the doctrine of the Trinity was invented. It's not that there isn't some amount of truth contained within the Trinitarian concept. Rather, it's that we've taken something out of its biblical context and now confidently use it to make ourselves think that we know what God is when we don't. We are not satisfied with only observing what God is or experiencing him. personally. Rather, we feel compelled and we feel perfectly able to do the very thing we shouldn't do, because our essential nature doesn't have the ability for it, and that is to define and understand what God is. This is the reason that for many years I teach you to stop asking why when you contemplate the Lord or you study His Word, and instead ask what. And the what concerns discerning what God pattern or which biblically stated God principle is at work in any given situation. Asking why is a good and reasonable question for trying to discover how our physical, temporal universe of time and space operates. But it's a wholly wrong and self-defeating effort to try and discern God in His holy scriptures by employing why as the method of discovery. Because why implies that we can uncover and comprehend the nature of God's mind that underlies the what. Asking why makes us think that we have the right to examine, to debate God's reasoning for His establishment of His principles and laws and commandments. But the Holy Scriptures teach us that the duty of God's people is only to obey His principles and His laws and His commandments, and to do so in a spirit of trust. Now, the Rambam argues that it's appropriate, or rather inappropriate, to employ even all the attributes ascribed to God in the Bible. We may use them in the biblical context when we come across them in the scriptures, but it's unbecoming, maybe it's even sinful, to speak of God as possessing human-like characteristics. We shouldn't remove a descriptive word from its context and then employ it as a means to define what God is, the most common of which in our age, anyway, is to say God is love. Human language always falls short whenever speaking of God. Words become devalued, and they can't hope to contain the cosmic mystery of God's being and His presence. Human language falters. It's utterly impotent. Although we are often certain that we finally captured God's essence in those fine words. If words have difficulty describing the beauty of a sunset, or a classic work of art, how much more so are words clumsy and ineffectual in describing the reality of God? Contained within the wisdom that God gave to King Solomon came Shlomo's stunning admission at the temple dedication ceremony that it is utterly futile to try and understand such things as God's omnipresence. That Jehovah could dwell here and there and everywhere simultaneously, and yet in the earthly human sense of dwelling, not reside any place at all, but merely place His name there. So in the end, all Solomon asked for is that no matter where God's people might be, that if they will direct their prayers towards God's designated earthly place of meeting, the temple on Mount Moriah, that God will hear and act on those prayers in His sovereign will. The mystery of God was not challenged or solved here in Solomon's prayer. It was simply accepted. That is the true scriptural definition of faith. Let's reread the remainder of 1 Kings chapter 8, starting at verse 54. you have a complete Jewish Bible, that'll be page 379. We'll start at 54 and go to the end. When Shlomo had finished praying all of this prayer and plea to Adonai, he got up from in front of the altar of Adonai, where he had been kneeling with his hands spread out towards heaven. He stood up, he raised his voice to bless the whole community of Israel. And he said, "Blessed be Adonai, who has given rest to his people Israel in accordance with everything he's promised. Not one word has failed of his good promise, which he made through Moses, his servant. May Adonai our God be with us, as he was with our ancestors. May he never leave us or abandon us. In this way, he will incline our hearts towards him, so that we will live according to his ways and observe his mitzvot, his commandments, his laws and his rulings, which he ordered our fathers to obey. May these words of mine, which I have used in my plea before Adonai, be present with Adonai our God day and night, so that he will uphold the cause of his servant and the cause of his people Israel day by day. Then all the peoples of the earth will know that Adonai is God. There is no other. So be wholehearted with Adonai our God, living by his laws, observing his commandments, as you're doing today." And then the king, together with all Israel, offered sacrifices before Adonai. And for the sacrifice of peace offerings, which Shlomo offered to Adonai, he offered 22,000 oxen and 120,000 sheep. Thus the king and all the people of Israel dedicated the house of Adonai. And that same day, the king consecrated the center of the courtyard in front of the house of Adonai, because he had to offer the burnt offering, the grain offering, and the fat of the peace offerings there. For the bronze altar before Adonai was too small to receive all the burnt offering, the grain offering, and the fat of the peace offerings. So Shlomo celebrated the festival at that time. And all Israel, a huge gathering that had come all the way from the entrance of Hamath to the Wadi of Egypt, celebrated with him before Adonai our God for 7 days, and then for seven more days, 14 days in all. And on the eighth day, he sent the people away. And they blessed the king, and they returned to their tents full of joy and glad for all the goodness Adonai had shown David, his servant, and to Israel, his people. Solomon had been in a kneeling position before God, his hands outstretched as he offered his prayers. But now he stood to address and bless the congregation of Israel. And for reasons the sages have debated for centuries, an important happening was left out of this narrative in 1 Kings, but we find it recorded in 2 Chronicles. In 2 Chronicles 7:1, we hear, "When Shlomo had finished praying, fire came down from heaven, and it consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices." I began this evening by asking you to put away your desire to know why. As in, why did God light the altar fire and burn up these offerings rather than just allowing the fire to be lit by the priests, as usual? Instead, our question should always be what? What God pattern or principle is being employed here? And we find the answer to that in the book of Leviticus, at the consecration of the wilderness tabernacle. In Leviticus 9:20-24, we read this: "Aaron raised his hands towards the people, he blessed them, and he came down from offering the sin offering, the burnt offering, and the peace offerings. And Moses and Aaron entered the tent of meeting, came out and blessed the people. Then the glory of God appeared to all the people. Fire came forth from the presence of Adonai and consumed the burnt offering and the fat on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and they fell on their faces." And I think we would too. So the unchanging God, of course, consecrated Solomon's temple of stone and wood in Jerusalem in the same way he did that portable one made of fabric and animal skins and wood at the foot of Mount Sinai. And in repeating this pattern, the people knew that the Lord pronounced that this place, this house, this temple was acceptable. And now it had been holified. In fact, in verse 56, King Shlomo invokes Moses' name, and he reminds the people that what's happening here is all part of the covenant that Yehovah had made with Moses 500 years earlier. May Yehovah be with us as he was with our ancestors, Solomon continues. Now, how exactly was God with their ancestors? Solomon never addresses it because it's impossible to put into words. Suffice it to say that God was with Israel because he said he would be. Because Israel's many victories over their enemies and the fact that they're now at rest in the land of Canaan, the promised land, participating in this dedication ceremony of a temple to Yahweh. This is experiential proof of God's promise of his mysterious presence being with them. But there was another strong implication in the statement about God's presence with Israel that the rabbis have noticed. It is that it was important for the people of Israel to understand that now that the temple was completed and consecrated, and that all of the Lord's promises made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob about arriving and settling in Canaan had been met, that God would not just leave them to themselves. So Solomon prayed aloud in front of the people that God would not abandon them because he'd not abandoned the patriarchs. And then finally, another strong statement is made in verse 60. And we see that the concept of there being only one God over all the earth, over all mankind, has finally begun to take root in Israel's leadership in a much more overt way than it had up to now. Solomon says that Israel needs to obey God, and God will in turn bless Israel. And in this way, all the people of the earth will know that Yahweh is God. There is no other. Two things. We have learned that a God's name was everything to ancient people. Knowing a God's name was the key to knowing what that God's attributes were, what functions of nature he or she was in charge of, where that God's territory was located. Yehovah was to be associated not to a territory, but to the entire earth. Why? Because he's the only God in existence. Second is how important that concept is for us today. We live in a world whereby many Christian denominations and those secular groups who want all of the world's religions to get along have adopted the belief that assuming there is only one God, then it's okay to use whatever name your religion wishes to call him, from Allah to Buddha to whatever you want. Solomon didn't say, okay, Canaanites, just know that Baal is actually Yahweh. Okay, Moabites, just describe everything you know about your god Molech to Yahweh, since Yahweh is the only God and you're actually just worshiping him. See, the idea was not that Yahweh was some kind of universal melting pot of every and all characteristics of the gods that men could apply as they wished, as long as they called him Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Rather, it was that the Holy Scriptures of the Hebrews are the source of defining God's attributes, of expressing his deeds, his principles, his commandments to human beings, and his name is Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. There is no other God. So, folks, there is no other name for God. The king now leads the nation in more offerings, more sacrifices, to the tune of 22,000 oxen, 120,000 sheep. Several classifications of offerings are listed. The chief of all offerings, the olah, the sacrifice that always accompanies an olah, which is a micha, And also the Zevah Shlamim offering was included. See, all the meat from an Olah offering is burned up on the altar. None of it can be used for anything. The Mincha is an offering of produce. Some of it's burned up, the rest go to the priests. The Zevah Shlamim, this has a small amount of the animal burned up. The rest goes to the worshipers and to the priests for food. The part of the Shlamim that is burned up is the Helev. This is the best fat. This is the fat that surrounds the organs. And generally speaking, all the meat of the Shlamim offering is used for food, for the worshipers, and for the priests. So we see that because thousands upon thousands of people came for this dedication and they would be there for two full weeks, guess what was needed? Food. So in a very practical solution, while some of the animals were completely devoted to God and thus entirely burned up to ashes, the Olah offerings, the far larger portion of the sacrificial animals were sanctified and then used for food for this enormous crowd. These are the Shlamim offerings. However, the sheer quantity of animals that had to be processed and offered in whole or in part on the altar meant it was physically impossible for the great altar of burnt offering to even handle it all. Thus, another means of accepting these sacrifices had to be arranged. That's what's being discussed in verse 64. There's much disagreement over the meaning of this passage. Some say that the king literally sanctified the courtyard, and there a wood fire was built upon the floor of the courtyard and the animals were burned up there. Others say that another altar was built. So two altars were in use. In fact, some of the sages say that what was being used at first for the main altar was actually the original bronze altar of Moses from the days of the wilderness tabernacle. But now Solomon had an excuse to build a second, much larger altar, and this larger altar is what was in the courtyard. But after the dedication ceremony, Solomon's new and larger one would be used to replace the more ancient, smaller one. Your guess is as good as mine as to which of any of this is even accurate. The final two verses actually give us information that we discussed in the first teaching I gave to you about this chapter. Verse 65 begins, "So Shlomo celebrated the festival at that time." Now, the word translated to festival here in the original Hebrew is chag. Chag. Chag is a pilgrimage festival. It requires all adult males in Israel to travel from wherever they might reside to the temple in Jerusalem. The dedication ceremony is not a chag. Therefore, this festival is something else. And in this case, it's referring to one of three possible God-ordained biblical feasts in the Torah law, among which are Matzah Shavuot and Sukkot. All of these pilgrimage festivals. I want to remind you that it is common in the New Testament and in modern Jewish conversation to call the first of these pilgrimage festivals Pesach, Passover, instead of Matzah, unleavened bread. But that's technically not correct. Pesach, Matzah, and Bichrim is the series of springtime feasts that occurs in rapid-fire succession. Passover first, unleavened bread the next day, and the day after that's first fruits, Bichrim. Passover is a one-day feast. Unleavened bread is a seven-day feast. First fruits is a one-day feast. It is the feast of unleavened bread that is the Chag, the pilgrimage festival. Not the Passover, not first fruits. However, a pilgrim coming to Jerusalem for the festival of Matzah, which for many would have involved an arduous journey, naturally wanted to come a day early so he could have his Passover lamb slaughtered by a priest, cooked in an oven in the holy city, and celebrate it with his brethren coming from all over the Holy Lands. Although only part of this was required. So we get next this cryptic statement that the gathering came and celebrated before God, meaning at the temple, for 7 days. And then it says, for 7 more days. 14 in all. And then we're told, on the 8th day, the people dispersed and went home. The first 7 days was the temple dedication ceremony. We know that the second 7 days, which was the Chag, was Sukkot, because there was an 8th day spoken of before they could leave, and that is the Torah ordained protocol for the Feast of Sukkot. So the throngs of people remained in Jerusalem for 15 days total. That must have been something to behold. Can you imagine all these people there? No doubt they camped out for miles around the city. Let's get started a little bit into 1 Kings chapter 9. Open your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 9. We're going to go ahead and read the whole chapter. 1 Kings chapter 9. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 380. After Shlomo had finished building the house of Adonai, the royal palace, and everything else he wanted to build for himself, Adonai appeared to Shlomo a second time as he had appeared to him in Gibeon. And Adonai said to him, I have heard your prayer and your plea that you made before me, and I am consecrating this house, which you built, and placing my name there forever. My eyes and heart will always be there. As for you, if you will live in my presence, as did David your father, in pureness of heart and uprightness, doing everything I've ordered you to do, observing my laws and my rulings, then I will establish the throne of your rulership over Israel forever, just as I promised David your father, when I said, you will never lack a man on the throne of Israel. But if you turn away from following me, you or your children, and you do not observe my mitzvot, my regulations, which I've set out before you, and you go and serve other gods, worshiping them, then I will cut off Israel from the land I've given them. This house, which I consecrated for my name, I will eject from my sight. Israel will become an example to avoid, an object of scorn among all peoples. This house, now so exalted, everyone passing by will gasp in shock at the sight of it, and they'll ask, why has Adonai done this to this land and to his house? But the answer will be, it's because they abandoned Adonai, their God, who brought their ancestors out of the land of Egypt, who took hold of other gods, worshiping and serving them. This is why Adonai brought all these calamities upon them. And at the end of 20 years, during which time Shlomo had built the two buildings, the house of Adonai and the royal palace, King Shlomo gave Hiram 20 cities in the land of the Galilee. Recall that Hiram, the king of Zoar, had supplied Solomon with cedar and cypress logs and with all the gold Solomon wanted. Hiram came over from Zoar to see the cities Shlomo had given him, but he wasn't satisfied with them. He said, what kind of cities are these which you have given me, my brother? So they have been called the land of Kabul, meaning good for nothing, till this day. Hiram had sent the king 4 tons of gold. And following is the account of the forced labor levied by King Solomon for building the house of Adonai, his own palace, the Milo, the wall of Jerusalem, the cities of Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had gone up, taken Gezer, burned it to the ground, and killed the Canaanites living in the city. Then he had given it as a dowry for his daughter, Solomon's wife. So Solomon rebuilt Gezer. He also built Lower Beit Horon, Baalat, and Tadmor in the desert, in the land, as well as all the cities that Shlomo had for storing supplies, the cities for his chariots, the cities for his horsemen, the other buildings Shlomo wanted to build for himself in Jerusalem, in the Lebanon, and throughout the land he ruled. All the people still left from the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, who were not part of the people of Israel, that is, their descendants remaining after them in the land, whom the people of Israel were not able to destroy completely. From them Solomon levied his forced laborers, as it is to this day. But Shlomo did not raise any of his forced labor from the people of Israel. Rather, they were the soldiers, his servants, administrators, and commanders, and the officials in charge of his chariots and horsemen. There were 550 chief officers over Shlomo's work in charge of the workers. Pharaoh's daughter came up from the city of David to her house, which Solomon had built for her. After that, he built the Milo. Three times a year, Shlomo offered burnt offerings and peace offerings on the altar which he had built for Adonai, offering incense with them on the altar before Adonai, so he finished the house. King Solomon built a fleet of ships in the Etzion Gever by Elot on the shore of the Sea of Suf in the land of Edom. Hiram sent some of his own servants, experienced sailors who understood the sea, to serve with Shlomo's servants. They went to Ophir. They took gold from their gold, 14 tons of it, which they brought back to King Solomon. The events of the opening verses took place at least 13 years after the temple dedication ceremony of chapter 8. Because we're told in chapter 7 that it took Solomon 13 years to build his palace. And he didn't start counting that time until the temple was completed. And in like manner, meaning in a dream, God visited Shlomo as he had near the beginning of the king's reign at Gibeon. Now, no doubt Solomon was in his palace when this visitation occurred. The tabernacle and the priesthood were no longer located in Gibeon, so there'd be no reason for Solomon to be there. In many ways, this visitation from God is connected with the first one. In the first visit, God had asked Solomon what he wanted from him. And Solomon asked for wisdom to rule over his people. Now, God was pleased with this request, and so he granted it. But as a bonus, gave to Solomon that which he didn't ask for: great wealth. Thus, in verse 1 of chapter 9, we're told that Solomon had not only built the beautifully appropriate temple, but also a magnificent palace that was such a wonder that other potentates came just to see it. And that Solomon had built everything else that his heart had desired. The sages point out that while the temple and the palace were important, they were necessary, by saying everything else that his heart desired means that Solomon built these other projects just to please himself and to gain fame. So God came the second time after the realization of Solomon's great wealth, and in response to Solomon's prayerful petition at the temple dedication ceremony. Notice again, it was at least 13 years after the temple dedication ceremony, complete with Solomon's famous prayer, that God came to tell Solomon that he would grant those petitions. 13 years passed. One has to wonder if the king even remembered much about what he'd asked God 13 years earlier. That's an awful long time of waiting to find out. Now, verse 3 is a little odd on the surface. Jehovah says, "He has consecrated the temple and placed his name there." Why would Solomon need to have this repeated 13 or so years later? We're not told. And I don't want to get into a guessing game. However, likely, after all these years, many trials had come and gone for Solomon, and the Lord saw the need to reaffirm his commitment to the temple as the holy place of meeting. And I also think that after all these years of priestly rituals and ceremonies that perhaps Solomon needed to be gently reminded, it was Yehovah who consecrated the temple, not Solomon, not the priests. And in verses 4 through 9, the Lord conditions his blessing upon Israel and upon Solomon with obedience to the Torah. And finally, he threatens Israel with the terrible consequence of exile and of the temple being abandoned by God and becoming an eyesore and a monument to Israel's rebellion and their apostasy. If I were to give a subtitle to this short section, I'd call it Behavior Matters. There are four ifs presented to Solomon in this dream visitation from Yahweh. That is, these are the four conditions set down for God's continued kindness and blessing over Israel. And since this is concerning how God deals with Israel as a nation, as opposed to them individual by individual, then as we have seen it developed in God's word, the national condition from God's perspective is reflected in the national leadership. That's scary. In this case, because Israel's a monarchy, the national leadership is one person, the king, King Solomon. And the four ifs are these. One, if Solomon lives in Yehovah's presence, this means being submissive to God, following his ways. Second, if Solomon displays pureness of heart and uprightness, this means integrity and morality based on God's definition of those traits. Third, if Solomon does what God commands, the idea is that Solomon doesn't passively pay lip service to the Torah. He doesn't merely say all the right things. It means to actually perform the deeds and the works that the Father instructs. Fourth, if Solomon keeps the statutes, the ordinances, and the commandments of God. This is speaking of the written laws and the regulations as they're presented to us in the Torah. The Hebrew terms are chok, mishpat, and mitzvot. And the idea is that together, all of these form all the rules of ritual purity, all the do's and don'ts that define morality, that defines the civil laws, that defines social justice and all the procedures for bringing about God's justice faithfully. If Solomon is faithful in all of these things, then the Lord will ensure that a king will sit on Israel's throne that comes through Solomon's line. Let's stop and remember here that David had many sons through many wives and concubines. So a number of family branches of David exist now. Much like Yehovah selected Aaron from the line of Levi to be the high priest, then from among Aaron's sons, the father ordained Eleazar to be the line from which further high priests would come, so it is the same for Solomon. But for Solomon's line to continue to supply Israel's kings, not some other descendant of David, then Solomon has to keep those four conditions. And we'll continue with chapter 9 next time.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.